The Questions Log, Week 9, Independence Day. The American dream is about a transcendence of class barriers, that with ingenuity and determination, anyone can rise above their station to the highest echelons of society. With our world's chosen gods in exile, what better time to see that dream in action? To watch and learn with the tables reset of the sort of person who will rise. Our nation's elite have ways of protecting their station. The only action left once you reach the mountaintop is to kick the hungry hands that reach for your feet. I believe the American dream is real. But as so many who have found it have grown to resent the climbers they once were or came from in a distant time, it's certain doom to try the climb alone. This is 52 Pickup.
And welcome to 52 Pickup, a podcast about the greatest comic book you've never heard of. My name's Gita, and I'm always joined by my co-host and friend.
It's me, Alex Jaffe, professional comic book expert.
He's a professional comic book expert. Can you believe that?
And I am here for you to talk about a comic book that came out 15 years ago.
I've just crumbled and turned into dust. Alex, I truly thought the thing that was going to make me feel the oldest this week was learning that every single member of the Korean boy band that I got obsessed with was born after 9/11. So,
oh, Lord.
Yeah. One of them was born at like September 22nd, 2001, mere weeks afterward. He's just devastating.
Where were you at 9/11? The natal care unit.
Oh, yeah, so you know what I'm talking about, dog. Like, the passage of time, it just do be passing.
Yeah, I have one rule when people ask me about comic book characters and the particulars of the comic book universes, and it's never ask a comic book character how old they are.
Yeah.
And the same rule applies to myself, I'd say. Don't ask me either.
Listen, I've reached the age where I'm an adult, and that's all you need to know.
Exactly. Right? You never stop being an adult.
Yeah, exactly.
I have achieved my final form. There's nothing after Blastoise.
Yes, this is exactly right. Man, so good to be in the booth with you as per usual. I feel extra energetic because I've just started standing at my desk now because of 30-something back problems. Speaking of the passage of time, but...
In solidarity, I've started standing with you so I can match your energy, and I am feeling it. My chakras are aligned.
And it's everything's lined up. I learned that I have mild scoliosis. So shout out to all our listeners with mild scoliosis out there. You're real ones.
As opposed to the spicy scoliosis havers.
Yeah. I've known some spicy scoliosis havers, and that's a struggle also. So.
Yeah.
Well, this week we are again talking about the best comic book ever.
I still love it. Every time I read this comic, I'm like, man. I can't believe this miracle happened.
There's so many parts in this issue that made me go, comic books, in like a really good way. And then there were some parts that made me go, comic books, in a different kind of a way. But we'll get there. I'm jazzed.
I'm super jazzed. But before we get into it, how about we talk talent?
Let's do that.
Now, there's a lot to talk about this week because the entire art team, starting with this issue, has rotated off. Other than the writers and the editors. This is an all new team working on 52 number 9. And that's going to lead to some complications that we're going to talk about later in this issue. The main penciler on this is Sean Moll. This is the first of three non-sequential issues that Sean drew of this series. Prior to this, he'd worked on Team Zero for Wildstorm. And he followed this up with a 5-issue run on She-Hulk. He's currently publishing his own original comic on Substack, No Signal. The inker is Tom Nguyen. He made his industry debut with Major Bummer in 1997. He does a lot of work with Doug Mankey, who's best known as a frequent Geoff Johns collaborator, did a lot of stuff on Justice League and Green Lantern. He's inked hundreds of issues and co-created The Switch with Keith Champagne, a fairly popular Kickstarter-funded comic. This is our first issue without Alex Sinclair on colors, but he will return. In this issue, we meet our series' secondary artist, David Barron, who's in 20 of the 52 issues. He got to start with Wildstorm, working with Mark Millar and Frank Quitely on The Authority, that run with the supervillain who goes back in time to molest one of the heroes as a teenager.
Jesus Christ.
Did you read that, Gina?
Comic books.
Yeah.
Sometimes comic books are comic books, and there's just, that's the only thing you can say about that. No, I didn't read that run because so many other horrible things happened in The Authority.
It's so hard to believe that Mark Millar went on to become one of those people who hate the woke mob and cancel culture.
I know, I can't understand it. The man that pitched the event, The Rape of Wonder Woman,
whose most acclaimed work, Old Man Logan, climaxed with the Hulk having an incestuous relationship with his cousin
to make a bunch of baby Hulks. With this man with, like, sexual violence. I don't understand. It's like a pathology for him. It's strange.
Lord.
Yeah.
But he's not working on this. His colorist is.
Yeah.
David Barron is still working with DC to this day on current titles like Batman Off-World, Suicide Squad Kill Arkham Asylum, and Neil Before Zod. Oh, man. Do we even want to talk about Suicide Squad? Should we talk about Suicide Squad? Maybe that's a bonus episode.
That's a bonus episode. You got to pay us. Subscribe to Aftermath. We have bonus episodes coming. More of that for y'all. But
yeah.
Please, if you want us to talk about anything extra material, you will have to pay us. So yeah, please do.
You have to pay me to talk about Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, which I am playing.
I was going to pick it up. I heard it's actually not as bad as people keep saying it is, but still not good, what I heard.
I just want to say, if I can make one observation about Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, it's very interesting that they created a Suicide Squad game where every character is expendable except the Suicide Squad.
That is pretty funny, honestly. That's a dumb irony. That's really funny.
Yeah. Anyone can die, except the people the game's named after. all right. The letterer is Jared Fletcher. He's lettered thousands of comics. He started with Archie in the 90s. He's basically everywhere. You've probably accidentally read something he lettered already. And that's our brand new crack team of artists. What do you think of this cover, Akita?
The cover I do like. I think the composition is great. It is giving me Lost again. I've been talking about Lost a lot with my husband, who was a big Lost head when the show was going on. I think it gives a lot more gravitas to the space hero adventure than actually occurs in series.
I'm going to make a wildly out-of-pocket comparison here. I would say that in the 52 Lost continuum, Devil Lance the Pursuer is the white polar bear.
You know what? That's like a one-to-one, actually. Like, it really is. For like a whole lot of reasons that I don't want to reveal on the pod.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, I've seen Lost. This is easily the best Devil Lance has ever looked, and that's partially in credit to the fact that no one ever really thought to use him after his one debut issue until Grant Morrison.
That's so true. It's so real. He looks so cool in this issue in particular, but it's like fourth world stuff just looks it just do be like that, right?
Yeah.
I watched the Eternals movie in what will become a part of a long form piece of criticism that might drive me insane. But I watched the Eternals film and it's like Jack Kirby's worst drawing clears the entire movie. And you can see why when you look at this cover. It's just like that man had an eye for design, and for no reason at all, they didn't use any of his designs.
The entire reason the Eternals exist is because Kirby had to go back to Marvel after DC screwed him, like Marvel had previously. He's like, well, I already used up the New Gods. Maybe I'll just do that again. So we get the watered down New Gods, and that's what the Eternals are.
I mean, it's so disappointing in the Turtles movie for them to just like
the new Gods.
They lean into the space age of it all. Like, why would you make it all look like it was shot in a parking lot and everyone's wearing bad costumes that are CGI? Come on, come on.
I will say he does kind of look like primitive hunter Galactus, but there's nothing wrong with that.
No, I wrote that in my notes, actually, that the thing about looking like Galactus is cool. Galactus is one of the coolest Marvel things. Like, it's really cool. Just the idea of this wandering giant spaceman that awakes like a god to eat the Earth. That's cool stuff. And this also captures what is cool about that, like, right? Like, he's a big, giant, massive man with the sun peeking over his shoulder like Atlas, you know?
And one thing I want to say in favor of the Eternals movie, is that if you compare it to, say, Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer, which came out 20 years ago,
good Lord,
which chickened out of showing us Galactus because they thought audiences couldn't take it.
Yeah.
But the only reason to watch Eternals is that it gives you all of those Kirby's designs right in your face.
Yeah. When it does use the Kirby designs for the non-human people, that stuff is cool. And it just makes me wish they use his designs for the actual characters' costumes and stuff.
Yeah.
Because even though they're sort of, like, they're very, like, Kirby's stuff is so graphical and, like, so designy and so not trying to look like something a human could wear, but that's what makes it cool. Like, that's what makes it fashion. Trying to translate that into a garment and not water it down, like, actually make it look like the thing that it is. That's why you would want to do it.
I was thinking of the Celestials, which I had to look up because it is not my job to know Marvel shit.
I always think about that one that has the cool dye job where it's like a circle in the back of her hair. Like something that would have been impossible to do with real hair until about 2 years ago. And, you know, he was ahead of the curve. He was.
Yeah. Nobody did it like Kirby.
Absolutely nobody did it. Nobody did objectivism like Kirby.
Shall we open this comic?
Yes.
All right. We're getting past the beautiful cover.
God, the opener is also so good. So we are week 9, day 1. Day 1, most of the events of this issue take place on day 1.
There's a reason for that.
What's the reason for that?
The reason for that is that this is one of, once again, Keith Giffen's original plot that 52 would revolve around the real events of the year as they occur, the seasonal holidays and such. All of this takes place on July 4th.
Oh, that is, so does not come across when you read it in trade. It's wild.
Yeah, I'll point it out, but that's all over here. Lex opens this issue by talking about the American dream.
He sure does.
The issue is called Dream of America. Later, we see fireworks in the sky. This all had to take place on one day because it was all about Independence Day, how the DC Universe celebrates that.
That makes this little speech that he gives, like, it's so out of pocket, but it's so in character for Lex Luthor. So Lex is, he's in Metropolis. It's at a party for the grand opening of his eugenics center, essentially.
the one that had Natasha strapped up in that fetish gear last week.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. His psychosexual eugenics factory. That's where he is. And he's giving this speech that it gives tech billionaire so perfectly. Like, this feels like something Elon Musk would say while talking about some, like, Neuralink, like the chip that he's put in monkeys' heads that kill them.
Oh, yeah. Pure Luthor.
Yeah. But what I love about it, what makes it so dastardly, like, cartoon villain, is the way it not only references the idea of the American dream, but Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
I know.
I love how just
when literally one issue ago, he was literally calling the people who signed up for this his slaves.
I know. But that is tech billionaire in a nutshell. Like,
absolutely.
The only time Zack Snyder cooked with his readings of the DC universe was when he had Jesse Eisenberg play Luthor like he was Mark Zuckerberg. Like, that was the only time he really got it.
I am going to credit that not to Zack Snyder, but Zack Snyder's brilliant casting director.
Yeah, I mean,
everything she touched was absolutely gold. The one,
it's
the
so
big
true.
Problem, I'll give you this for free outside the paywall. But the big problem with the DC movies has never been casting.
Oh, that's absolutely true. No, I agree with you. And that's kind of a gimme. That can be a note outside of the paywall for sure. I absolutely agree with that. I'm not as big of a fan as Henry Cavill's other works, but when you look at him, you see the vision. You understand
it. He could be a good Superman.
Yeah, if he had better material. Anyway,
Superman's dead right now. He's not around in this comic.
Yes, they all end this speech opening it up with everyone cheering to toasting to Lex, and they're saying, God bless America. I love it when they're on their hating America stuff.
Yeah.
Comic books. I do love that. But who interrupts him? Who interrupts him?
It's our man, John Henry.
It's our man, John Henry. He is now Steel, literally. very much literally steal.
Lex makes the obvious joke. Looks like your skin finally matches your name. Steel just beats his ass and asks, where the hell is my niece right now? Where's Natasha?
Yeah. He knows something's up. Natasha's not around. He's looking for Natasha. Well, he's unfortunately about to learn, though, that Natasha is on the future type New Genesis super team, unfortunately. And after, you know, Steel demonstrates some new powers also, he's able to turn his fingers into molten steel, and that burns. We see a pretty white woman literally get burned by the flicks of steel that come off him.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Not gonna lie.
That is pretty cool. And I can see the writers here. Yeah. It feels very related to Emma Frost from the X-Men when she got her diamond form, where it's like, let's show off that this is a new part of this character and that other writers should use this right now.
I mean, what very much reminded me of is the old Superman Blue arc from the 90s when Superman gets electric powers, and it just changes the way he interacts with the world.
Yeah, it's because, you know, John Henry's big thing is that he's a self-made man, you know, like very literally. He made his own suit. He's got the big hammer. He's not the strongest, but his skills as an engineer is what make him powerful. Here, he suddenly has superpowers. So he can come in and just brute force strength things in a way that he was not able to before.
Sure enough, Natasha shows up with a bunch of other people who have been adopted into this program in some of the most hideous superhero costumes you've ever seen.
You look, green and purple are complementary colors, but they look terrible here. They look really bad.
The green sash breaks the purple jumpsuit, so it looks like an L to show that they belong to LexCorp.
Yeah.
Keith Giffen in the liner notes for the 52 Omnibus confessed that he was the one who designed these and fully admitted he wasn't on one that week. He apologized for it and was.
Yeah.
And they tried to get them out of these outfits as quickly as possible.
It's just, it's not giving anything, right? Like, I think the thing that you want for superhero outfits of all kinds is, could someone realistically cosplay this and would they look cool in it? Like, the best example of that is the Batgirl outfit with the yellow Doc Martens.
Mm-hmm.
That was an instant cosplay hit.
Yeah.
Like, no matter what else you put on that character with the yellow Doc Martens, that's iconic. Here, they're just nondescript.
The reason Punchline took off a couple years ago is entirely because of cosplayers.
Yeah.
The reason Gwenpool took off is because that's an incredible costume design.
Yep, absolutely.
This one is, it's not happening here.
It's just nothing. It's like a reject figure skater designs.
So we have these five other heroes who show up behind Natasha. What are your impressions of these weirdos?
One of them literally looks like a Kewpie doll, which is so not good. It's so bad.
It's so bad.
Oh my God. She's got these, I think that they were trying for Bantu knots, but this was before a time when people were looking at reference pictures of black hairstyles in order to draw them correctly. Like, for some reason, we were just not evolved enough at this point in time. So they just are little tiny braids that stick straight up, and she looks like a Kewpie doll. Like, she looks like a racist stereotype.
Her hair will change along with the costume later in the series. God.
The only one that looks good is Heracles, and he's just got a big L on his chest. He's half naked. Like, that's just it.
I also like the obsidian-looking dude in the front.
Yeah, he is cool. You, except for the one that looks like a Kewpie doll, they do look like you looked up man in the dictionary. Like, that's what you just found a picture of one.
You know? It's just three dudes, the Kewpie doll and the Shadow Man.
Seriously.
Characters TBD.
The Shadow Man, I mean, he looks like something from the 90s also, which I think is why he looks so distinct next to this very, like, this was around the time when digital color had really been figured out.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 90s and into the early 2000s, when digital coloring was still very much a technique that was like a moving target, you saw a lot of characters that were all filled in black because that means no shading.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There were people whose entire job was to just fill in the blacks in a comic.
Man, that sounds like ASMR.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish I could get that job, but no, that's AI. Computers taking our jobs now.
Yeah, that's content aware, Phil.
God, so many people put out of jobs by the paint bucket tool.
God.
Where do we go from here?
So now, after Natasha and the Lex Luthor eugenics team has been, they get their little splash. It turns into an argument between Natasha and John Henry. And yeah. It's very shonen anime-esque in that they are fighting each other while explaining each to their ideologies to each other.
Oh, it's a fight that literally takes up half the issue.
Yeah.
Most of this comic is about this fight.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's drawn really well. I'll say the splash page that we go right, the two-page spread that we go into mm-hmm. right into the in the next page. I love that drawing of John Henry with the I love the color that they've given the skin. It looks so good. Like, especially as he's being punched out a window and like he's juxtaposed against the night sky with the fireworks, which I now do see and understand. It's like a blue, silver, gray, and that could look very drab, but they've highlighted and colored it really well. And the colorist has paid a lot of attention to how shadows would reflect off of it and how light would reflect off of it.
Yeah, Alex Sinclair is one of the best colorists in the industry, but David Baron in his first issue here is really showing off that he can keep up.
Yeah. Some of the character faces look, to use an anime parlance, look a little off model, but it makes sense. Yeah. Like, they're not badly drawn. They just look different from the previous issue.
I mean, different issue, different artists. It tracks.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that, in general, I was not surprised to learn this was an all-new art team, but
yeah.
They're really flexing, though. Like, this splash especially is very good.
Yeah, there's a lot of dynamism going on. I like them smashing through that Booster Gold ad.
Yeah, yeah, I love that too. I really like the body positions that Natasha is in when she demonstrates her powers. There's a lot of showing her twisting at the hips to show her in these sort of bodybuilder type poses to show how strong she is now. It's really, I also love the smirk she keeps giving where she's gone fully supervillain. It's very fun.
Yeah, especially when faces are strained, the art does look very Mankey-like, which is probably due to the inks here.
Yeah, man, but it's a good, we're going back into this 9-grid panel layout, which, you know, is television. The 9-grid to the 4-grid, which gives you like a push into the drama.
The 6-grid to the 4-grid.
Yeah, the 6-grid to the 4-grid. I can't count. Like, anyone who's listening to this by now understands I don't know what numbers are, and I'm saying things that sound correct in my head.
All multiples of 3 are basically the same.
Yeah, exactly. It's all 9. All of them are 9.
I mean, all numbers below 10 are close enough in astronomical terms.
Alex Jaffe, your support means the world to me. But yeah, they go from the 6-grid, although I love this little tiny cutout face of John Henry going, get out of the way. And then to the 4-grid, like you can feel the camera pushing in. You can feel how television this feels, where they go from the farthest possible view of the action to more frenetic, faster paced action to a slow down, dramatic pull in so that the characters can definitively speak their piece before one of them wins and one of them loses.
And that philosophical debate essentially comes down to, you're not my dad, you can't tell me what to do.
That's basically it. It's that Onion article about 9/11 and the Iraq war that's like, this will cause like a domino effect that will irrevocably change the Middle East versus no, it won't.
No, it won't.
It's like the John Henry is the one that's like, don't you see this man's a crazy eugenicist versus no, he's not.
What about that weird bondage gear he strapped you into? Everybody does that. I saw Luthor do it.
I bet he did, just to try it out. Yeah. He's featuring like Mr. Smithers. So funny. Yeah.
I'm not telling our listeners to draw that fan art, but I'm not forbidding them from doing it either.
Listen, do what you want. I can't stop you.
Yeah.
But he must have tried it. Why else would it be that horny?
So she beats her uncle up and flies away, and we go back to space. The planet that the cover blurb described aptly as Planet Hell, which I love.
It pretty much is.
We get this very hilarious shot of Devilance the Pursuer squatted on the floor playing with like his equipment like he's a toddler.
Yeah, it's me playing with my cat, basically.
Yeah.
Like, what is this? What do you want me to do with this?
Animal Man and Starfire and Adam Strange are all tied up and caged. And we get a treat from Grant Morrison for Animal Man fans, returning to that kind of first person narration that we saw in their original Animal Man series.
Yeah, I wrote this in my notes, but this is very much in the same exact style. Like, the voice comes back into my head so naturally. It's been years since I reread their first, their run on Animal Man. Mm-hmm. And it put me back into that mindset immediately because of how unique that voice was and how strongly they developed it. Especially at the very end of the scene, the thing that Animal Man says is very Animal Man, the series coded. Mm-hmm. But this is why I initially wanted to love the Space Heroes, because I love Animal Man quite a bit.
Yeah.
And this is maybe as good as it gets for him in this book.
This issue.
But this is a great scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a great scene for him. He uses his powers in one of those ways that I genuinely really enjoy. Everyone forgets it. Animal Man's not useless. Guess what? He knows a lot about animals.
Exactly. And animals can do some weird shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I do love that. Very Animorphs coded. We do love that.
Yeah.
So they are tied up while Devil Lance is on the ground scrounging around. And Animal Man realizes that there are insects in the room. So that he's not actually powerless in this time. Insects are strong relative to their body weight, and they can also literally fly.
Right.
Those are things that Animal Man can tap into that would be really helpful in this scenario.
Yeah. One of the most popular superheroes of all time has the powers of a spider.
Yeah, exactly. God, the amount in my neighborhood, which is like a majority black neighborhood. Here's the things that I see on children all the time. Spider-Man paraphernalia, Sonic the Hedgehog paraphernalia, mm-hmm. and Demon Slayer paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Those are the three.
Makes sense.
It makes sense. Like, they all have guys that are like that. I like the way that this little action scene plays out. I also like Adam Strange signaling his jetpack from afar for the distraction, and then the three of them going in and Coriander literally stealing Devil Lance's lance. Now yeah. just Devil.
Now you're just Devi. You're Devi now.
What part does the L belong to? Does it belong to the Devil or the Lance?
I think if he was Devil Lance, there would be two L's, Gita.
Wow. Okay. So it's Devil Ants.
Yeah.
I love that Coriander steals the Lance because that is absolutely what she would do. That
yeah,
is
sure.
100% in character. She's like, big stick, I'll take it.
She's got the strength. She was trained to wield weapons on Okara. She knows what she's doing.
Yeah, it's if the Space Heroes stuff was as good as this issue was every time, it would be the best stuff in this comic book.
If you grew up on the Teen Titans cartoon and that's how you got to know Starfire, you lose a lot of background context about her being trained as this warrior so she could have the strength to inherit the throne of her people. And that really comes through over here.
Yeah, they use her like an action character for the first couple issues. They used her as eye candy, which is also what she was designed as, to be completely right. perfectly honest. But they finally get to the part where they get to use her as a beautiful Amazonian warrior, which is another Jack Kirby-ass thing. So I'm always in favor of that.
I got no problem with it. Of course, she was Starfire was co-created by George Perez, who had one of the most iconic Wonder Woman runs of all time. So
yeah.
that does track one to one.
It really does track one to one. Man, the original Teen Titans is really great. I love Perez. Sorry. I love the way he draws that hair.
The new Teen Titans. The original Teen Titans were this whole other thing, but we don't have to talk about that right now.
Okay, we don't have to get into that, but thank you for the correction.
Comic book fans are nothing if not pedantic, so if I don't point it out, someone else will.
Yes. I do want to highlight before we move on to the next scene, which is my favorite part of this whole issue.
We can't yet.
Okay.
Because we got to talk about why the hell Devil Lance was after them in the first place.
Simply, why was Devil Lance after them in the first place?
Adam Strange tries to explain it. He says, someone thinks we saw something humans weren't meant to see. And he told me they've put out a contract on us. Even if we make it off world, we're going to have every bounty hunter in the known universe on our tails. So it's become this fugitive story that someone we don't know knows that these characters have seen something they're not aware of, and they need to be taken in before they can do something with that knowledge. It's vague.
It's too vague. Too vague to be a hook.
Yeah.
You can see why that information just slid right out of my brain, right?
Exactly.
Because I was spending a lot of time trying to figure out this line from Animal Man, Yeah, but what was he talking about? All of that walls of heaven stuff? And I'm like, when was he talking about the walls of heaven?
Oh, he was earlier in the scene. He talks about you saw beyond the veil, beyond the 2 score and 12 walls of heaven.
I see. I was not understanding where the speech bubble arrows were pointing to.
Yeah.
There we go.
So at first I thought that might be a reference to like Animal Man's ability to see beyond the fourth wall, that he has observed the viewer before.
Yeah.
Very famously in Morrison's Animal Man, but it might be something else.
Yeah.
We'll see where they take that.
What I really like about this little scene, though, right at the end, is that it does the thing that made the Animal Man, Grant Morrison's Animal Man, so good, which is what we call dramatic irony, where the audience knows something that the characters do not.
Right.
So as the narration is over the last 3 panels, as he's narrating in first person, Animal Man, Buddy, our good friend Buddy Baker says, that's what I love about being a superhero, the endless complication. And what we see, of course, is that Devil Lance isn't dead, but is alive and is still pursuing them.
As Devil Lance says, he's the god of pursuit. It's the reason he exists.
Yeah. So he will pursue until the end.
Corey already took his lance. Pursuit is all he's got left.
You know, it's just a good use of dramatic irony. And I love it. I love when TV does this. I love all forms of fiction where you get to know a secret that the characters don't know.
Oh, it's terrific. Especially in this kind of Lost format, which is all about secrets unfolding.
Yes, exactly. The mystery box, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So moving on to Gotham, night one.
Sure. Here we are at Molly's, the premier lesbian bar in Gotham City.
This is the best thing ever to happen in a comic book.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. It's one of the best things ever to happen in a comic book, though.
This whole scene is very much that Simpsons scene where Homer is like, there's something wrong with this. Wait a minute. This lesbian bar doesn't have a fire exit.
It's so true. It made me think about the discourse that was going on like maybe a week ago where lesbians were talking about making straight women who go to lesbian bars uncomfortable, and now maybe they should do that a little bit more. It's very funny to watch all of these people in Molly's Gotham's premier lesbian bar on the 4th of July.
Watching a baseball game.
It's a Butch Star.
Yeah.
It's a lesbian sports bar.
Yeah.
You know what? Fair. Fair enough. I bet those do exist.
We hear over the TV that the 7th inning stretch is being led by mayoral candidate Oliver Queen, who I will remind you in the last issue insisted that he was not running for mayor. But, you know, that's what mayoral candidates say until they do.
If he was a real man, he'd be Hassan Piker. That's true. You can't tell me that's not true. And he'd be so irritating.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. God, I love this. Not only is the 7th inning stretch being led by Oliver Queen, Renee just laments, I can't believe we're losing to Star City.
Yeah.
It's so funny to me for some reason that the Gotham City residents are like, Star City, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. What a hole. We were just there. They're like upcharging diapers there.
Seriously.
To unhoused people. And they're beating us. So there's this one guy in a baseball cap in the middle of our lesbian bar, our Homer Simpson.
He could not look more like a cisgender heterosexual man, also. He's got a baseball cap and like a sleeveless shirt with his very masculine arm muscles peeking out.
Even so, the women there redirect him to Dixieland, which is obviously the equivalent gay bar.
Yeah. Just really, really funny also. I need to know what the LGBTQ nightlife scene is like in Gotham City. I bet it is crazy.
I will say we know from James Tynan's run, I believe, that there's another gay bar in Gotham called Conroy's, appropriately enough.
Sorry, that's really funny.
Alyssa Yeo, who is Barbara Gordon's ex-roommate and like one of the first openly trans characters in DC Comics, she's very active in like Gotham's queer rights community. There's a lot of her in DC Pride stuff. Yeah, so the scene is a scene, and I don't know if there was one before 2006. But there is one now.
Great. We love that. I love that there is, like, other writers have picked up on this thread and are running with it. Because Can you imagine what, like, the drag scene is like?
Yeah.
Superheroes are basically already drag, but then you've got your city's superhero is Batman. Batman must be doing crazy lip syncs.
Yeah.
You know? That must be wild. But I love this. I love how mad Renee is that the place where she thought she wasn't going to have to see a man has been invaded by not only a man, but a man she knows.
Well, she doesn't know she knows him yet.
That's true.
This is the first time Vic Sage is revealing himself to Renee outside of his costume, in his other costume, one might say.
The stank face she makes, though, when he makes a pun about questions.
Yeah, she's like, oh, this fucking guy.
It's so good.
Do you have any idea what the HD on his cap stands for? Because I have no idea.
I do not know. I could not possibly know. You're the one that knows these things. If you don't know, I don't know.
I could not find it. It's probably some non-comics thing, which it isn't my job to know.
I'm the references to outside culture person.
Yes,
okay.
I assumed
Sorry.
It was like...
I failed you. I don't see it. I don't know what that stands for, unfortunately, unless it's literally just high definition.
Yeah.
Think so.
That's all I got. So he tells her, my name's Vic, but my friends call me Charlie, which is kind of the nomenclature he had going on in Denny O'Neill's question series, Charles Victor Zsasz. Volume 2 of The Question Omnibus by Denny O'Neill and Dennis Cowan just came out. I proudly have it on my bookshelf. My collection is complete. Wouldn't you think I'm a girl who has everything?
I'm so proud of you.
It's wonderful. It's got all the old letter columns in the back. I couldn't ask for a better collection.
God, yeah. Love it. I love when the collect volumes have the letter columns. I think those are so special.
Yeah. So he makes Renee come follow him to the back alley and they talk there.
Yeah. And he shows off how he gets into costume also, which is a treat.
Yeah. This is something Steve Ditko was kind of obsessed with back in the 60s. Ditko, maybe because of Spider-Man, was very wary about how easy it is for villains to remove somebody's mask. So in 1967, when he had that double bill working on Ted Kord as Blue Beetle and The Question in the backup, they both had these mechanisms in place which kept people from removing their masks. Ted Kord's was locked with like this key at the back of his skull that you could only remove his cowl if you like unlocked it. And Vic Sage had this binary gas where he would put the mask on and the gas would mold it to his face.
I love that. It doesn't make any sense, really, but I love it.
No. But it's just, this is why the villain can't just tear the mask off. It's him explaining that.
Ditko, your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what Ditko's doing. So this is Vic explaining the tools of the trade to Renee for, I don't know, kicks. I don't know what he has in mind explaining how this works to Renee Montoya.
I have no idea what the significance of that could possibly be. Crazy.
Yeah, why am I teaching you this? I don't know. It just seemed like something you'd be into. Renee asks Vic who he is. He says, I asked you first. He's been asking her, who are you, since before they met, really. Which is kind of the same thing he was saying to Helena Bertinelli through Cry for Blood, which did not end well. But the reason he's here is because he's got more information about the case they've been following. Those weird weapons and mutants they saw in that warehouse on Kane Street are associated with Intergang, the villains from Jack Kirby's New Gods and Superman. And it just kind of feels, at this point at least, that this plot line that introduced Devil Lance the Pursuer, a new god, is starting to converge with this Gotham storyline, that maybe it's all coming together. Because Intergang's whole thing was that they were a weapons-dealing criminal organization that reported to Darkseid for some reason, before they kind of figured out what Darkseid did. But that connection existed from, like, the very beginning, from when Darkseid was still a Jimmy Olsen villain. And we're seeing that play off here, and it's something Morrison's going to continue to play with going up to Final Crisis. And that's when we see there's a figure overhead watching.
Yes, and this figure is wearing an outfit with a cape and a cowl and a bat symbol on their chest. But they're not Batman, because Batman's doing some stuff right now.
Yeah, Batman's discovering himself. Now, this panel right here we see of a close-up shot of Batwoman in costume was a big fuck-up.
Really?
Yes. I wouldn't necessarily call it a spoiler, because at this point, Batwoman was already showing up in advertisements. She was showing up in promos and solicits. But this was issue where she was kind of like perched above them. The notes for the issue itself had her kind of draped in shadow, teasing her. Her big debut, and it's framed as a big debut 2 issues later, is supposed to be in 52 number 11. But because this is a brand new art team all working on this issue together, they didn't get the memo. Mm-hmm. So they ended up shipping this out with Batwoman in full color, the costume fully revealed. So as far as collectors are concerned, this is the first appearance of Batwoman in costume, but that wasn't supposed to happen until 2 issues from now.
Interesting. Narratively, it works so well, right? Yeah. And it still feels like a reveal because we don't know anything about her until 2 issues from now. But that's really interesting how a creative project that's moving really, really fast and really how it ends up revealing things they didn't mean to reveal initially. I love comics.
There's no time to right the ship. Everything has to be right the first time.
Absolutely.
And for some reason, miraculously, that works most of the time on 52, but it's inevitable we see a crack here and there. Fortunately, not a fatal one.
Yeah.
One more thing I do want to talk about is that at the time that 52 was being published and people were trying to figure out the mystery, there was a very popular fan theory about the question that he wasn't Vic Sage at all, but he was actually Ted Kord, who was keeping an eye on things. And this is the issue where we see him out of costume that blows that theory out of the water. Oh, I guess it was Vic after all.
Yeah. Ted Kord, God bless. Shout out to a real one.
God bless. But, you know, Vic's my boy. So yeah. I can't be too mad.
No. It ends up being one of the greatest question stories ever. So
it is unquestionable.
Unquestionably.
I did not mean to say that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I apologize.
It's fine.
It was too bad.
I thought you were doing it on purpose, though.
I know. That's why I'm apologizing.
God. So now we have to go into the backup, which made me so
Here
angry.
We go. History of the DCU.
Oh, my God.
Now, this feature has no new talent. We don't have to talk about the talent. This brings us up to the event right before Infinite Crisis, Identity Crisis, written by famed novelist Brad Meltzer, who was brought on to show you that bam, biff, pow, superheroes aren't just for kids anymore.
He is literally that personified. And I think that this summary of the events of the Identity Crisis really explained why I don't like Identity Crisis at all, and I hate him personally on a personal level.
I've met Brad Meltzer. He's very nice.
Oh, I'm happy that he's a nice guy. Yeah. I have questions for him.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of questions. Let's start out with Identity Crisis was one of the first DC things I ever read. I was a teenager and didn't sit right with me. And this was at the time where the internet and like the collective passion of nerds on the internet that compile information was just beginning to happen. So I was able to actually look at reactions to Identity Crisis and also look at what the characters were like before Brad Meltzer got to them. And I realized very quickly the characterization of this group and the events that happen here seem incredibly unlikely when you actually look at what the characters were like and what their relationships were like.
Yeah.
It basically, Brad Meltzer, what he has done is retroactively added a lot of quote unquote mature topics into what was a relatively lighthearted period of time for the Justice League, to the degree that for me, it feels like character assassination for especially Jean Loring and Sue Dibney.
Now, I will say, to Brad Meltzer's credit, I recently reread all the old Adam and Jean Loring stories in the Bronze Age Justice League of America, which is very much what this is drawing on. And she was very, very clearly unraveling there. Like, if you were following that narrative thread, like, she was, like, all the weird shit she had been through just for being associated with the Atom, she was just, like, moments away from snapping at any time. And I feel like if you actually sat down and read those 200 issues of Justice League of America, it paints a picture of a character who is about to do something very drastic. I don't know if she would do this.
Yeah.
But
let's get into it.
She needed help. She really needed
help. I'm glad at least that has something as a basis, because I don't think Meltzer does a very good job of queuing up the actions that she takes, right? Like, if you read Identity Crisis in its entirety, it really does feel like he pulled the culprit out of his ass. Like, it feels... Yeah. So the entire story of Identity Crisis is a murder mystery. And I think that the backup actually does a good job sort of setting up what the tone of it is, because it starts off with, like, Donna Troy sort of cues it up in her narration like a murder mystery. And in particular, this one line, I knew Jean, I can't believe she did it. You know, that kind of thing of alluding to information that the audience doesn't yet know.
Yeah.
Mad Meltzer adds in this event, this inciting incident for the unraveling of this league, where—
I'm sorry, did you just call him Mad Meltzer?
Didn't mean to, but did I?
I kind of love it.
Big Mad Meltzer.
Yeah.
He adds a sort of inciting incident where after they discover that Sue Dibney was murdered, they immediately think it was Dr. Light. Why? Because they never told anyone, but Dr. Light sexually assaulted Sue Dibney in the past. And they all kept it a big secret because they wiped his memory so he wouldn't brag about her sexual assault, which is a deranged thing. Just that whole scenario is deranged.
Yeah. All of that is absolutely wild.
It's just like my dog sat down and wrote that down and was like, don't need to work on that any longer. No notes for me. That all makes perfect sense. Print it. Yeah.
I will say almost every decision ever made in the history of superhero comic books is just as crazy. It just doesn't feel as bad because it doesn't involve sexual assault.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And if you read Identity Crisis, it's like very graphic on screen. Yeah. And it feels disgusting, especially because all the characters are wearing their goofy ass, like,
yeah,
Bronze Age outfits. Like, it feels nasty. Like, it feels, if yeah, it was more intentional and a better comic, it would be brilliant. But it's not.
You mean like Watchmen? You mean like when that thing literally happened in Watchmen, Kida?
Yeah, exactly like that.
It's like Brad Meltzer jumped into comics with both his feet and he's like, well, guess I'll be Alan Moore.
So many people try to do that.
If you come at the king, you best not miss.
Exactly. And it's just a whiff here. It's an absolute whiff. Like, if that's going to be your motivation for getting into comics, you better be Grant Morrison. Like, and Grant Morrison doesn't even clear Alan Moore, you know? Like,
No.
It's messy. You can feel like the neophyte energy from the writing. Like, it just feels raw and unexamined, and it's like dark for the sake of being dark. And what you end up with is two female characters dead for the sake of one plot point for the lead up of Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
And it just is disgusting. I hate that.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah. So the other thing that happened in the sexual assault, by the way, was Jean Loring. Jean Loring did it because she wanted her husband to love her again.
Yeah.
Which is like, again, like, fuck you, dog.
The Adams ex-wife, she borrowed his suit to shrink down onto Sue Dibney's brain and tap dance on it until she died.
Yeah, because she wanted her ex-husband to be like, oh no, they're targeting the wives, which,
yeah,
make that make sense. The motivation for the character, I'm glad that it's got some basis, but the extremity, yeah, of the action does not make sense. It just doesn't.
It's very well researched. The entire plot of Arthur Light knowing the identities of everybody is something that was grounded in an issue of Justice League of America that actually came out a million years ago. Mm-hmm. He's someone who very much did the reading. I'm not sure he captured the tone of the reading.
Yeah, I feel like there could have been a secret conspiracy and there could have been a murder mystery, doing a very Watchmen-esque sort of look back on the golden age of something and revealing it wasn't all that golden. But it's just Watchmen does it better. And like, why are you making me think of something that's better?
I don't know. Good thing DC would never do anything like that with Watchmen again.
I'm just going to sink slowly through the floor into the basement. I'm just going to be doing that. I'll see you in a minute. The only thing that's really important from Identity Crisis in terms of leading up into Infinite Crisis is revealed that Batman ran in on them altering Dr. Light's memories, and they also altered his memories. So that leads to Batman losing trust in the Justice League and creating his own dossier on all of the members and a satellite to keep out.
Yeah, he creates Brother Eye, the satellite that's going to play a major role in Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
Which we've talked about on the show before, I believe. But yeah, and you know, meanwhile, in the paradise dimension that Golden Age Superman was sent off to in Crisis on Infinite Earths, he's just watching this and getting madder and madder.
That's me, actually. It's just me vibrating with rage.
Yeah. Like, the entire Kal-El storyline is Tim Robinson in the banana suit. We're all trying to find the guy who did this.
That's exactly what it is. It's so funny. God, it's so real. I dare someone that listened to this podcast to do all of the backups, but just do them in. I think you should leave sketches. Just the entire history of the DC universe. I think it's possible.
I think you could do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much wraps it up for this issue. I think we have the same favorite scene.
I think we do too. It's the question at the lesbian
bar. It's Molly's. Anytime that Vic and Renee are moonlighting at each other, to borrow the parlance of the editors, that's the best thing. There is no better storyline.
I love the moonlighting, but with no chance of romance. It's moonlighting for the concept of being a superhero. I love that.
It's so good.
It's super, super fun.
It's my asexual dream. It's all I want for myself is what Vic and Renee have. Me and who? Me and whom?
Banter. This man just needs someone to banter with.
Yeah. I think it was John Rogers who said that all that anyone wants to watch on TV is good-looking people bantering while they solve a difficult problem.
This is so real. Like, why is television not like this anymore? That's the only
thing people want to watch.
Do not give me an 8-episode meditation on grief. Don't do that to me. Like, give me attractive people solving a problem. That's what I need.
Not even like a hard problem, like a medium problem.
I like it when, like, in Star Trek, they're just solving a workplace dispute. And then by the end, they're all like, good job. Like, that's what I want.
Not an easy problem like Entourage, and not a hard problem like The Wire, but a medium problem like Star Trek.
Solving the problem of crime in Baltimore is pretty fucking difficult.
That's too hard.
That's too hard. Television can't handle that. No, we can't solve that problem, unfortunately. David Simon got in a fight with me once over union stuff. Dude, your show is so good, but podcasters belong in the union. I don't know what to tell you.
You want to go to the blackboard?
Yes, and my blackboard thing is inspired from the backup this time, because we already talked about my other thing I want to throw on the blackboard, which is just like what the LGBTQ nightlife scene in Gotham. I just feel like that is just, someone write a book about the best gay and lesbian bar in Gotham. I would read that in a heartbeat.
You want to read the DC Book of Pride, written by my good friend Jadzia Axelrod, which I did some research for.
We're mutuals on Blue Sky, so.
Yeah.
I think she's really great.
Yeah, we should have her on the show.
We should have her on the show.
I'll see what I can do. I'll see what I can do.
The other thing I wanted to throw just quickly, because it's just like a comic book thing, but the nature of shared universes leads to this, and it's the concept of character assassination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone comes up with a character and someone else is like, fuck you. And they just do, they take the an uncharitable read of that character's behavior and amplify all their worst traits. And that's just something that happens in comic books. And that's why you'll see many different interpretations of characters. I think a lot about Grant Morrison's interpretation of Magneto in their new X-Men book, where it was like immediately post 9/11, and Magneto is like this great Jewish anti-villain in a lot of ways, but also Grant Morrison was like, they're just a mad old terrorist twat. And you know what? That's a valid interpretation of what Magneto is, but it's also wrong.
Yeah. I think a lot about, say, the character assassination of Guy Gardner, who is a way bigger jerk as of the 80s Justice League International, because they needed a jerk character to the point that kind of became his default personality.
Yeah.
I think about Jason Todd being co-opted by serial sexual harasser Scott Lobdell for 9 years.
Made that character so bad. It's so upsetting.
I mean, some of these character assassinations, they go on for so long that it becomes the character.
Yeah.
And it's just heartbreaking. It gets harder and harder to reverse the more it catches on.
Yeah. Luckily, the girlies really did save Jason Todd, I think.
Jason Todd was always for the girlies.
That's true. Jason Todd's for the girls out there. Absolutely. If the Bat Family was like a K-pop like dance group, like singing group, Jason Todd would absolutely be the leader, I feel. Like, they've just got that energy.
All I'm saying is that in the 2010 movie Under the Red Hood, when they cast Supernatural's Jensen Ackles to voice Jason Todd, that was the best casting decision anyone has ever made.
They absolutely knew what they were doing. It's like a Hurt Comfort fanfic, everything that Jason Todd's been through, you know?
He is Hurt Comfort personified.
Absolutely. It's so true, and it is one of the things that makes shared universes so frustrating sometimes. I think we did also see this in the DC Extended Universe, where people got really afraid Zack Snyder's vision of what Superman is would be an entire generation's people's idea of what that character was, when that's simply not how I see him. So I just want to throw that up there because I think 52 does an excellent job with keeping with the spirit of characters, but is building off of stuff that I feel like totally went off track.
It's evolving those characters. It's these creators who did not create these characters taking what they themselves love about them and bringing it in the next step. It's exactly what a collaborative universe should be.
Yeah.
It's the best kind of fan fiction. It's that loving attention to detail fan fiction.
Yes. This is the good version.
A lot less sex, but maybe that's why I'm a comic fan.
So true. Don't look on AO3. Just use...
Or do.
Just like listen to... Pay attention to the tags. People mean them seriously.
I'm not your dad. I'm not a cop.
You crack me up.
I am as much your dad as I am an officer of the law. Though I am those things in equal measure. In pounds or tons or ounces. All the same. Anyway, what I would like to put on the blackboard is the way that Grant Morrison interprets the New Gods. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something it occurs throughout their work. On JLA, on their crisis events, in the Multiversity. Grant Morrison applies the idea of a new god literally in the way that I don't think Jack Kirby ever intended. Jack Kirby kind of meant new gods in the way that these are super powerful beings from another world adjacent to our own in time and space. Whereas Morrison is interpreting them as is their wont, with the JLA being equivalents to the Greek pantheon, as a pantheon in their own right. They're not just gods, but all of them are gods of something, which is something I don't think Kirby himself ever thought of.
There's a seed of it there with the idea of Mr. Miracle being a super escape artist.
Yeah.
You can extrapolate they're a god of escape. They're a god of freedom in some ways, but that's not
what Morrison does.
Yeah.
But it's not inherent in the text.
Exactly. Exactly.
Some of them are obvious, like the Black Racer is an obvious death god. Mm-hmm. Metron is a god of knowledge. Darkseid is a god of evil. But I want to play a game with you, Gita, right now, where we're going to go through some of these new gods, and we're going to figure out what they're the gods of.
Okay, great.
All right. What do you think Big Barda is the god of?
Wife.
Oh, yeah. She's the god of marriage. She's Hera.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it makes sense. Makes complete sense. That wasn't just a guttural, uncontrollable reaction I had to thinking about Big Barda.
No, but you're absolutely 100% right. Jack Kirby created Big Barda as the manifestation of I love my big wife.
Yeah, exactly. That's 100% true.
All right. Okay. Let's talk about Orion, the son of Darkseid, who was raised by Highfather and is... He's fated to kill his father. What is Orion the god of?
Beef, like rat beef.
Yeah, he's the god of grudges.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know, Light Ray? Light Ray's kind of a god of joy type figure. He's kind of the carefree guy.
Yeah, think of it as, what's the one in the Greek pantheon that races the sun?
Hermes,
yeah.
Apollo. Apollo races the sun. But I think Light Ray is very much a Hermes, kind of like a trickster figure.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about Kalibak. Kalibak is Darkseid's son who he constantly ignores like he's one of the Roy children. And he's very angry about it. He's like, I deserve this. I'm the eldest boy. And nobody pays attention to it.
The god of fail sons.
Yes. Oh my God.
No, we should do this. We need to do a succession themed AU story for the new gods.
You could absolutely one-to-one map Logan Roy onto Darkseid.
100%. The same attitudes towards parenthood and success.
Yes, yes.
And the same tolerance for failure.
Yeah. Just blasting people with his Omega laser vision going, fuck off!
I'm going to Photoshop that. I swear to God. I have to now.
It's his fuck off beams. What's Granny Goodness the god of?
Oh my God. child abuse.
I guess so.
It's the god of being a stage mother or a stage parent, right?
Yeah.
You know, I can picture Granny Goodness. She always reminds me of the horrible, like, abusive instructor from Dance Moms.
Yeah.
That's what she's giving to me.
I would say she's the god of generational trauma.
Yeah. I think that's more accurate, right? Like, especially with the whole, like, ironically charming grandmother thing that she does, where it's like, I'm going to be nice to you. And by nice to you, I mean make you feel horrible about yourself.
Granny loves you. Personally, my favorite part of Tom King's Mr. Miracle was the way he wrote the gentle cruelty of Granny Goodness. Just like,
yes,
he absolutely nailed that character. She was terrifying.
Yeah, I know you have beef with the way that he writes his central characters and giving them all the same voice, which is definitely true. But I think that that book in particular, demonstrated the work in terms of getting all the other character voices really correct. I loved when Big Barda's giving birth and all of the fellow Granny Goodness,
the Furies
come, and they're just to, because they're, she's her sister. Yeah, they're fighting, but she's their sister. So,
speaking of Furies, what is Stompa the god of? Stompa is the Fury who has big boots and stomps on things.
Stomping!
She's the god of stomping. Oh, you know what? She's like Dionysus. She's the god of wine.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone's got to stomp the grapes.
Lucille Ball in the I Love Lucy sketch. That's her.
That's her. God. Absolutely. One of my favorites, Glorious Godfrey.
Oh, I love Glorious Godfrey.
He's kind of based on Billy Graham. He's kind of based on Bill O'Reilly. He's
the god of daytime talk show TV.
Yeah.
He's the god of Ricky Lake.
The god of misinformation. The god of propaganda.
Absolutely. Yeah, the god of propaganda.
He's the god of lies. He's Lucifer. He's the god of lies.
Yes. See, it does work.
Yeah.
Graham Morrison was onto something. All of these characters, because
they're— Some of it works, yes.
Some of it works. Some of them are a stretch, but a lot of them work enough that it feels appropriate when you create a pantheon out of them.
Okay, last one I'm going to bring up then is Vermin Wunderbar, the guy who's just kind of like Kaiser Wilhelm slash a Nazi, like Herr Goebbels. He just, like, one of the guys in Darkseid's inner circle is just literally a Nazi.
Just a Nazi guy.
He dresses like a Nazi. He talks like a Nazi. He's just a Nazi in space.
Why would he do that?
I don't know.
Who could be anything else?
Well, I do know why he did that. He did that because Jack Kirby fucking hates Nazis. That's his one thing.
Chill. Great. Okay. We can just make him, I guess he would be the antithesis of the god of hating Nazis.
Yeah.
I don't want to give Nazis a god, though. They don't deserve that. They really do not. Maybe just generally the god of just the creepy little fuckers.
Yeah. Like, the god of creepy little fucks.
Yeah, the god of slimy little pieces of shit.
You know, god of bigotry.
Yeah.
God of small-mindedness.
God of small-mindedness. I really like that.
Yeah, god of scapegoatism. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the god of not my fault.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've done the Lord's work here. How about we move on to answering the questions? This is the segment where if you want to ask us a question about the DC universe or our opinions about comics or pretty much anything else, you could write to us at, what's our email address?
It's a 52 pickup at...
It's 52 mailbag.
It's 52 mailbag at gmail.com.
Yeah. Someone picked up 52 pickup. It's a phrase that existed before us. So I imagine someone went with it. Don't email them.
Email us.
And don't email my wife.
Don't do it.
I am playing a game no one else is playing on this show where I try to make Gita break as often as possible. And I'm just racking it up.
You're really good at it.
Bing, bing, bing. All right. Our first question comes from Aiden C. Who says, I just want to start by saying I absolutely adore this series. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to listening to the podcast each week. You're going to have to listen every other week like everybody else. Like Gita, I started reading on Scans Daily. And between this and Young Justice, it's what got me into comics. My question is, that as someone who seems primed to make the leap from page to screen, why do you think we've never seen The Question on TV? I feel like you could either go Vic or Renee, but I really could have seen either of them becoming a recurring character in the CWDC shows. Once again, love the show. Now, I actually know the answer to this.
Ooh, tell me.
Mark Guggenheim, the showrunner on many of those shows, desperately wanted The Question to be part of the Arrowverse. And he was trying to get those rights the entire time, but he couldn't because the question was tied up in another project that he couldn't talk about. And years later, we find out that that project, which spent 10 years in limbo, was a movie written by Kevin Smith.
No.
Kevin Smith had called dibs on the question and spent 10 years fighting with studios because his vision was too dark.
I'm giving Jaffe a face right now. Yeah. I'm unimpressed.
Yeah.
Unimpressed with the studios.
They yeah.
God, come on.
I don't know. I don't know if there's a winner there. I don't know what I would have wanted to see. I don't know if I would want to see the question in the Arrowverse. I don't know if I want to see that question Kevin Smith movie.
I would see the question in Legends of Tomorrow. Only that yeah. show, though.
Yeah.
Just that one. I think that
that would have worked.
That would have worked. And I feel like there's a creative energy on that show that is, it clears the other CW DC Universe shows.
I would have loved to see the question bantering with Matt Ryan's John Constantine.
Yes.
That's the dream.
Yeah. That's what I would have wanted.
Yeah.
DC did like a fiction podcast, like a real audio yeah. drama style with the.
They do a few.
Yeah. If they did, but like an old school one with like the sound effects and the, you know, all of that stuff. That would be an incredible pod for the question, right?
For the question? Well, guess what? There's an incredible audio drama adaptation of 52, which we're going to talk about yes. at some point, which has exactly what you're
yes,
talking about.
Yes, right? Here. Like, you understand what I'm yeah. saying here. It's he's so radio serial coded that I feel like TV is almost too much technology for a question devoted like yeah. like program. But he works great in an ensemble.
He's like an Orson Welles The Shadow.
Yes.
You want an audio thing.
Yes. That's exactly how I feel. Like, I want to like sip on that while I, you know, have my little morning coffee and put it on the radio.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our next question. I'm going to let you have first crack at this because this is a spicy one. I've been looking forward to this one. Hello, Gita and Alex. In the latest episode covering Stars in Their Courses, Alex briefly touched on the new 52-era Dan Didio editorial decree that led directly to J.H. Williams III and W. Hayden Blackman walking off the Batwoman book. They left the book right before the climax of their story, a story I was very invested in at the time. This happened in 2013, over 10 years ago, and yet this remains my deepest comics grudge. I've never forgiven Dan Didio for this, and I probably never will. So I ask you both, what is your deepest comics grudge? What past comics-related event continues to make you mad in the present? Loving the podcast. Thanks for all you do. Emily.
The shit that happened to Stephanie Brown. The shit that happened to Stephanie Brown was evil.
You mean by Bill Willingham?
Yes.
Bill Willingham, who is the internet's darling because he's a champion for public domain rights right now for some reason.
I'm just going to push him down a well. I'm sorry. I believe in a well-based system of justice. It's not the death penalty. You're just like, it's like Samara in the ring.
Yeah.
You'll just go down that well and stay there. Because you know, Samara, when she was in the well, she discovered art. She was doing some art therapy.
Thanks for making your Zionist analogy public domain, dude.
God.
I'm sure I'll get right on using that.
Not just Zionist, but anti-abortion.
Yeah.
I can't stand that, dude. I cannot stand what he did to Stephanie Brown. I cannot stand it. Talk about character assassination in a very literal sense.
I have gotten past that personally because Stephanie Brown is alive and well and thriving in comics right now. The damage has been reversed. The evil has been defeated.
I still can't forgive it. I just remember like reading Skins Daily yeah. every day, like hoping for someone to be like, oh, by the way, they said psych and she's fine. You know?
It was absolutely retconned to hell. Nobody talks about it anymore. And it's like, I don't think about it anymore. It doesn't bother me like it used to bother me.
The wound is simply too deep on a personal level.
There's one thing I cannot forgive. It's just this deep thing, absolutely like pitted in my core. And the worst part of it is there's plenty of valid reasons to be okay with this, to be cool with this. In fact, Gita, you yourself were extolling the virtues of this thing earlier in this episode. So you're going to be on a different side of history than I am on this. But every single day for the past 13 years, I have felt a painful aching in my soul over the loss of Oracle. Oracle was
yeah.
this incredibly unique character to the history of DC Comics that, like, She came out of a really shitty thing. Mm-hmm. But what John Ostrander and Kim Yale did with her in Suicide Squad was take that terrible thing that happened to her and turned it into this story about like how you can be a hero even if you're not an able-bodied person. If you have, mm-hmm. even with the challenge, with the challenges and the different physical realities we face, we can still be assets, to the point that as Oracle, Barbara was a more important hero to the universe than she ever was as Batgirl.
I think it's 100% true that Oracle is the only reason why Batgirl came back.
Yeah.
You know, I love the costume they gave her. I'll be saying, I didn't actually read the book where she came back because I was also similarly frustrated. Like, that character, Barbara Gordon, has all this year of character development as a person who's completely come to terms with their disability and has one of the rare stories of disability, right? Where someone is disabled and they don't resent the able-bodied, like of the fantasy that able-bodied people have about the disabled. But they just have to live their lives and figure out how to continue to be the people they were before the disabling incident.
Yeah, there's this incredible story. I think it was Gail Simone, but I might be wrong. Where during the Oracle letter, she confronts Joker and she tells him, "You took nothing from me."
Yeah.
She's stronger now than she's ever been.
Yeah. It was a dumb editorial decision, I think. And I know why they did it. I do get it. Because the fact that Batgirl, Barbara Gordon, got shot in the first place was made out of a decision that was not taking into account the character's personhood.
Yeah.
But after it happened, so much character development happened, and that character became so important to the DC universe.
They took out the block that was like one of the most unique and powerful and inspiring women in the entire universe.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, now she's one of 30 bats in Gotham again.
Yeah.
Anyone could do this job.
I keep waiting for her, for that character to go back to being Oracle, because I feel like Loki, at one point, one of the many people like me that grew up with Oracle rather than Batgirl is going to be like, let me put things back the way I like it. But I feel like it's not as powerful if she hasn't been shot.
Exactly. In comics, for the past 5 years or so, she has been kind of switching back and forth between the Batgirl and Oracle roles. But if mm-hmm. she can, like, put her feet up on the desk while she's, like, Googling everything about Mr. Zazz, what's the point even?
Yeah, because she could be punching him.
Exactly.
You know, the point was that she was a non-combatant but wanted to still be in the fight.
And she did it better than any of, like, the 50 other people in Gotham City could have.
Yeah, she became irreplaceable because she wanted it that bad and she wasn't going to let anything stop her. And then suddenly they have to give her a different set of problems that don't make her as interesting because
it's not like we didn't have a different Batgirl. We have two great Batgirls. We have Stephanie Brown. We have Cassandra Cain, one of my all-time favorite characters.
Cassandra's so good. Cassandra was also going to be one of my grudges, although they've repaired a lot of the character assassination damage.
They repaired that very fast.
Yeah, they realized that there are not very many Asian American characters in the DC universe, and they had to do something about that.
Yeah, there's a reason Cass is front and center anytime DC is like, a salute to Asian heroes, because like, this is our one.
This is the one we got. Like, the other ones, don't ask about them. Don't ask about
them.
They
have more, but that's the one that like people know. And even then, it's Cassandra Cain. How many people know her? I could talk forever about Cassandra Cain. Maybe we'll talk about her in, like, if we ever cover Harley Quinn in the Birds of Prey, because woof, there's a lot going on there.
Oh, my God.
Boy.
But
grudges. I still got them. They still burn me up. Bring back Oracle.
The Oracle thing is just, it's unsolvable. And that's what hurts, really.
It's not, though. They have this whole thing where she's like, oh, I've got this, like, cybernetic implant, but if I exert myself too much, it might break. And they kind of tease us like, oh, maybe. And just do it. Just like have this adventure where Barbara sacrifices herself and overexerts her implant. And she's like, well, I'm in the chair now.
And make it her choice.
Yeah.
Make it her choice rather than something a moment.
Give her the agency. It can totally be done. Anyone who says that any writing problem in comics cannot be solved, they haven't read DC Challenge. They haven't read Commandy. They haven't read anything Grant Morrison has written.
That's true. That's very
always
true.
A way out.
Yeah. You know, Grant Morrison's whole thing, especially you can see it in the Batman run they did, especially. It's like, let me take something that sounds impossible and figure out how to write it into existence. And it's that like level of creativity that I think makes people just obsessive super fans of Grant Morrison. But you're right. You know, you're 100% right.
That is the magic of literature. Just because you can't imagine how this can be done doesn't mean someone else can't.
Grant Morrison, one of the things they love to do is write themselves into a corner and then be like, aha, I wriggled out of it again. You know, the thing, you know, it would be such a great turn. I can imagine the narration where like it's such an anime type thing where a character is like, I gotta go push beyond my limit. Blah, 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 you know?
Yeah. Giga Drill Breaker.
Yeah, seriously.
United States of Smash.
Yeah. God, I love comic books, but also sometimes comic books, you know?
I love comic books enough to hate comic books. That's what
I'll say. That's exactly so real. It's so many different subcultures for me. Punk music, comic books, television writing.
Yeah, when I criticize comic books, it's because every single moment I'm thinking about them. I love them so much.
Yeah. All right, dude. Are we good for this episode of 52 Pickup?
I do have one more question for
you. One more question? Let's do it.
Yeah, this is it.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Pickup is an Aftermath production created by Gita Jackson and Alex Jaffe and edited by Esper Quim with original music by John Ahrens. The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the show's personalities and do not reflect those of DC Entertainment or Warner Brothers. Please rate and review our show wherever you can and send your questions and comments to 52mailbag@gmail.com. Never stop reading comics.